This book that I did, Healing from Hate, it's a book about young men who did some really terrible things. Neo-Nazis, skinheads, Aryan youth, white supremacists, and former jihadists. And yet, I have to say it's my most optimistic book.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum in Harvard Square, and thank you for joining us to discuss an important and troubling issue for all Americans, the increasing prevalence of hate crimes. What are the root causes of violent extremism, and what encourages young men to get involved in hate groups? To help us understand this complex equation, we have Professor Michael Kimmel. He's Distinguished Professor of Sociology and Gender Studies at Stony Brook University in New York, and author of a fascinating book on the subject, Healing from Hate, How Young Men Get Into and Out of Violent Extremism. I'm Mary Stack, the director of Cambridge Forum, and tonight, in addition to Professor Kimmel, we have two guests. Tony McAleer flew here from Vancouver, Canada today, and Frankie Menk flew in from Des Moines, Iowa. Both of these men are former neo-Nazis, and both are founding members and speakers for the group Life After Hate. So my question is, how does one, first of all, are you ever cured? Or is this something you're going to have to do like AA for the rest of your life, keep around people with positive attitude to reinforce the message? And also, how do you make up for that huge hole in the brain circuitry once you take that buzz you get? How do you fill that?
I believe that at the root of a lot of this is toxic shame. And toxic shame, John Bradshaw, I think, defined the term, but it's like an impaired sense of self. It's not something conscious, it rests in our subconscious. And, you know, because of events that happened to us, you know, as a child and growing up, we pick up the belief system that we're not good enough, we're less than, we're weak, we're unlovable, all of these things. And we live our lives in reaction to that. It's interesting if you think of a very famous politician, I won't mention his name, for I don't want to get sued, but you know, he doesn't drink. His brother died of a drug overdose and drank. And I look at that, you know, at the polarity of that, there's an alcoholic parent in the background. Mm-hmm. The need to win and dominate every interaction and deal, like it's a zero-sum game. He always has to prove that he's a winner, tells me that that alcoholic parent was probably very abusive. And when I looked in the family history, it's there. That's toxic shame. Toxic shame, I think, is at the root of violent extremism, but it's at the root of addiction. It's at the root of gangs. It's at the root of violence.
Bullies.
Mm-hmm. It is at the root of a whole spectrum of antisocial outcomes, all of which cost society a great deal of money. Some of it, or a bunch of it, is done towards other people, verbal abuse, violence, extremism, gangs, all the way to murder. But it can be addiction, self-harm, eating disorders, cutting, all of that stuff, all the way down to suicide. The problem with toxic shame is it's a lousy predictor. You can't say, because those things are there, you're going to end up in one of those spectrum. But you often find when people leave the movement, other symptoms show up. Addictions are a lot of them. They often don't show up with just one. So there'll be white supremacists and alcoholics, or they'll leave the movement and get involved in gangs or drug addiction. So I think there is that, certainly that addiction piece. And then I think when you think like that all the time, when you're in that perpetual state of anger and frustration and all you read and talk about, the brain is plastic, right? So it forms neural pathways. So the way of thinking actually does become addictive. You become conditioned to think that way. And I think there's some interesting science and research that's just beginning to be done around what fires up in the brain when people are thinking different thoughts. So we can rewire the brain. You know, we have the ability by repetition to rewire it another direction. And I certainly spent a lot of time doing that. People do that for, you know, if you want to quit smoking or you want to break a habit or a pattern, you can train your brain to think the other way. So I think there's both the the addiction quality of real addiction, and then there's the condition quality of the brain that has to be overcome, but both are able to be overcome.
I know that for myself, right as I was getting out, about a year or so later, this thought process kept coming in my head and it kept saying, you believe because of the color of your skin, you're better than somebody. Like, are you, like, to me, that's the most idiotic thought process in the world, right? That, to me, that's shortened what you said, but I just think I'd be an idiot to believe that someone cannot be as good as me at something or worse than me at something. So that thought process couldn't, I would have to have a brain injury probably to be a racist again. I would. It'd have to be something that would totally take off the frontal lobe of my head, because my frontal lobe somehow has been adapted to grow again, I hope. It feels that way. It's where I learned empathy and sympathy. But I know that the way that people can point stuff out to me is just by being real. And it doesn't have to be politically correct. You know, so when I'm sitting with a guy who's, I'm not going to be politically correct. I'm not going to use the N-word or nothing to get his trust. Trust me, I ain't going to go there with him. But I know that I can be honest with him. And that's the same thing a sponsor does in 12-step. Yeah. Because 12-step programs, by the way, does the same thing. The 12-step, in the 12-step program, because I'm part of those groups too, is empathy. You now go help the next guy that walks in the door that has the same story you do. Hmm. 1 through 11 fixes you, and in 12 you have empathy. And that's just what we've kind of come across. Hmm.
When I was in the movement, the ego was driving the bus.
Yes.
And I was disconnected from the heart. The ego was driving the bus. And the ego should never be driving the bus. And I've learned to have my heart now drives the bus. And now the ego can chirp like a backseat driver all at once, but as long as it's not in charge, things are okay. And I'd just like to say, and I'm sure I can speak for Frankie as well, there's no questions that are taboo or you think it's, right. I don't know whether I should ask it. Feel free, we're here with 100% transparency.
My question actually is connected to what you just mentioned, and it seems that part of your transformation and change had to do with getting in touch with your heart, your emotions, and becoming comfortable with that in a way that you had never felt or learned growing up. And this speaks a lot to the issues around studying masculinity as a sociological construct and so on, and I'm wondering if you would comment on that more, Professor Kimmel and the guests as well, but how masculinity, as we understand it today, affects the way in which young men and boys are raised to deal with their feelings and emotions, and how that relates to our guests. So I really look forward to hearing your answer, and thank you all for hosting this event.
I spent a lot of time with a coach and a mentor and a therapist who taught me leadership, taught me what it means to be a man. When we're children, when we're babies, we aren't in control of anything. Everything happens to us through a parent or whatever. We are totally dependent on other people making things happen for us. And if it doesn't happen right, it's someone else's fault. And I don't think we really become men until we take responsibility for everything in our lives upon ourselves. Hmm. When we're pointing the finger at other people, we are still like the child. Who doesn't have a soother or the bottle of milk. And I think once we make that transition of total accountability and responsibility for being yourself and what you bring, your children and what you bring into the world, I think that's when you make a step. And I learned that was what, a good part of what being a man was all about.
And I remember we went to the summit together in 2011, and we were sitting together when we were all talking about one of the things, even with the jihadist and the IRA bomber. I mean, there were so many of us people at that summit. I can't believe Ireland let us in, but they did. But the age of 14 is so huge for boys, because it's where people are starting to tell you to man up, don't cry, stop crying, man up, but also listen to your parents. And you're cut and you're stuck in this traditional life, and that's hard for kids that have problems. To stick with that. When you're 14, you're trying to break out of that mold. And anyway, so the age of 14 is huge. It's a huge point where I think we need to put more into looking at that age and the kids around that age. So,
For me, the one thing that a lot of my work over the years, especially in my first book, Manhood in America, the big surprise for me was that I that if I as I read through all of those how to be a, you know, how to be a man books from the 19th century, the 20th century, was that masculinity is, as we understand it, is it's a performance, and that the people who are judging it constantly every single day are other guys. Mm-hmm. That what you want is to be a man among men, a man's man. And this is not to say that women are not important in this, but they are often a currency by which men signal to other men what kind of men they are. Think, for example, of the photograph of me with my arm around my girlfriend. I am saying to you, look at what I got. Mm-hmm. I am so rich, powerful, strong, great, whatever. I got her. So women then are a currency. What we really, the conversation, and you think about the proving manhood all the time, is proving it to other guys. So when other guys, when you feel as you did, that lack of validation, that lack of being seen, and somebody, and guys say to you, we see you, you're one of us, we love you, you're our brother. It can be, it is addictive. It is that adrenaline. It is that excitement, like, I belong. Mm. And I think that that is a manhood quest. And it's not biological or anything. That's, I think, how we have culturally come to understand it.
Who's got the bigger TV?
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about if you saw abuse in other people's past as well. People who were encouraged to join white supremacy groups. Yeah. Did you see a lot of physical abuse in their past? Which I'm curious about that because I wonder if that's, in our society today where there's a lot more encouragement of people to come forward and talk about abuse that they've dealt with. So I'm just curious in terms of the long-term prevention of people even joining, if there's some sort of way that we could infuse that into the way that we prevent people from even joining these groups to begin with, to create a more open society of preventing abuse and also encouraging abuse survivors to come forward earlier in their life.
Yeah, I'll answer very quickly. I was shocked as I did these interviews in Germany and in Sweden, but especially in the US, how many of the people that I talked to had stories of being physically abused or sexually abused as children. I was not prepared for it for some reason. I just didn't think it was that pervasive. But boy, was I was really shocked by that. So it seems to me that, now, this is not, I'm not gonna make one some kind of causal argument that, you know, obviously, you know, but because the overwhelming number of people that I heard from did give this kind of narrative, this story as a beginning, it's a story of separation. It's a story of distance from family, distance from love, distance from self, that then spurs a kind of quest to find it elsewhere. That's the only thing I could say, but I was really surprised by it. I do take your point.
If I could just add a quick thing to that. I wasn't the only kid that was beaten at Catholic school. There were millions. Mm-hmm. I wasn't the only kid that had infidelity in the home. Mm. There were millions. Mm. I went down a path, like I said, there's a whole spectrum. I went that way. But those same things happen to someone else, could take them this way.
Right.
How is it that typical liberals can deal with their own hate of the white supremacists? Because that's something I experience a lot, is it's a sort of reverse hate thing. And I wondered if somebody could speak to that.
If shame is the source, you know, of all of this stuff, shame can't possibly be the answer. Mm-hmm. Right? And so I think that the level to which we dehumanize other human beings is a mirror reflection of how internally disconnected and dehumanized we are. And I think everyone in this society has to look at themselves and go, who do I dehumanize? And yeah. It's not about taking care of it. We have to be the change we wish to seek. Mm. And I liken it to Vancouver McDonald's had kale salad. Kale salad McDonald's. So how does kale salad get there? You know, it's not a passing of legislation. It's not rules and regulations. It's the choices that everybody makes with every bite of food that they put into their mouth. It's millions of tiny little acts of kindness, compassion, the way we treat each other in every moment of every day that is going to make the difference. Mm. And that's the challenge, is who do I dehumanize? And, you know, when we're compassionate or we do an act of kindness or compassion for someone who we don't feel deserves it, it's incredibly powerful for both you and the person. Go and try an act of kindness to someone who you don't feel deserves it and see how it makes you feel. and pay more attention also how it makes the other person feel.
And when I used to be in these marches and rallies as a neo-Nazi and holding the banners, people would throw bottles and snowballs and rocks at us. I never ducked a snowball or a rock. I was like, whoa, I better rethink my beliefs here. You know, I didn't do that. I was like, now there's my enemy. They're right there, and I'm with my boys. You know, I never stop. Punching a redneck in the face at a rally isn't fighting racism. It's punching a redneck in the face. That's it.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
My question is, there's been a lot of talk about masculinity, but no talk about the rise of feminism and whether women finding their own voices and not putting up with some stuff has had played a part in people feeling like their masculinity is threatened.
So I'll tell you, my wife, who I've been with now for 18 years, married for 18 years now, so God bless her. I would put it this way. I grew up with mostly dating hood rat girls. I mean, if anyone knows what I mean. Just girls, you know, girls from the neighborhood. Who I've come to find out that, like, the girls that I grew up with, they always demanded attention. They always go to parties. And so-and-so talked about me. Same way I was, you know, they're looking for a fight. And I remember when I first met my wife, I noticed that she didn't demand attention, but she definitely demanded respect. And that was where I first knew I was marrying a woman. You know, a real woman, not a girl. And I know that my role with, and Michael just talked about it. When I have done something wrong, I don't want to get onto this, but I have to make an amends. And when I had to make an amends to the world, it isn't I'm sorry. Everyone's sick of hearing sorry. I was, how can I make it right? So what I tried to do is I tried to make sure I treated my wife right. But the feminism coming up is not existent in the white supremacist movement at all, because women are just have two jobs, and that's to be nurses in a race war and have babies and cook. You know, the same old stuff you always hear. And so that always, and they were used as a currency. So when women started to stand up for themselves in our movement, they usually would be exited out of the movement, you know, too strong, too loud, you know. So, but that's just the way the movement always was, is that it is still, is that it's about more.
Men's vulnerability to being seduced to the movement is a result partly of women not feeding their egos in the same way they used to.
I've been out of it 25 years. I've been married for 18. My ego's gone.
I want to make two very quick comments because there is a division in the white nationalist movement on the position of women and on the role of women. If you go to the traditional, older white nationalist groups, if you go, for example, to the Klan website, you would find that women, their vision of women is pre-feminist. Women should be home. There's Aryan cookbooks. There's age-specific curricula for homeschooling your children so that they don't have to deal with the multicultural world. That's the vision of a large number of the white nationalists. Tony was part of White Aryan Resistance, and one of the things about them that I think was really interesting is that they actually thought that women could be just as kick-ass skinhead as guys could. It was one of the things that I thought was really, you know, kind of interesting about. So there is that split, because there are a lot of women who want to be, you know, skinhead fighters too for their race. The one thing I would also say is that feminism lurks in the background in a lot of the American case. But if you read Anders Breivik's manifesto, he's concerned with two problems in Europe, and they are multiculturalism and feminism. And he makes a long case about how feminism has emasculated Scandinavian men so that they're now, you know, utterly whipped by women. So there is a way in which feminism still has a kind of important role as a kind of background against which to measure the emasculation of men.
Yeah, my concern has to do with what prompted your decision to exit. You said earlier that it was due to the birth of your child, right?
It started a process of thawing, right, and when I had to make a choice between the movement and my child.
Yeah, so you said something along the lines of you feared going to jail. I just want to make sure I didn't hear that part correctly.
When I was 20, before there were any children, I was in the sort of whole male bravado that goes along with all the fantasies of violence in the movement. I believed I would be dead or in jail by the age of 30 as a white revolutionary, and I was okay with that.
Sure. So I guess what my concern has to do with is the position that you hold currently. You're a CEO of the Life After Hate movement. And I believe earlier there was a question that was brought up that has to do, it was something along the lines of, can you ever be cured? What were your motives to actually exit the program if now you have such a powerful position?
You know, when I left the movement, I still had all the ideology and beliefs.
Right, yeah, right? That's a concern.
There's two parts to people leaving the movement, and then we help them through them. The first one is disengagement. And that's when they leave the behavior, the social groups behind, but they still have the ideology. We look at that as really, at a basic level, harm reduction. You know, they're not going out and doing anything anymore, so that's the sort of the first step. The hardest part for someone leaving in that is a place in the middle I call the void, mm-hmm. where they, before they go into a white supremacist group, they basically excommunicate themselves from friends, family, and society. Then they go into the group. When things don't work out in the group, the honeymoon phase is over and all of that stuff, and the dysfunction sets in, to leave, they have to excommunicate themselves out again. The problem is, in the middle, you end up having to have no social circle. Mm. And that's really a key part where we help them. Mm. Once we get to the other end of disengagement, that's when de-radicalization kicks in. That's when the belief systems are dismantled. And it wasn't until 2005, I left around 98, that I met a mentor who's ironically Jewish that helped heal all the stuff that made the movement attractive for me to begin with.
Can you go into further detail when you say they helped you heal, the how?
Therapy, group therapy. He held me accountable for what I did and he challenged me. You know, one of the most recent challenges was to go and apologize to people. I've heard it's really easy to say, I'm sorry. But he said, I want you to do something first. I want you to say, how did what I do harm, how did what I do affect you? Mm. And then shut up and listen. Mm. And then say you're sorry. And so these are all different things that I've done. Because the hardest part in this, and this is the mission statement of Life After Hate, to inspire people to a place of compassion and forgiveness for themselves and for all people. If we have compassion for everybody over here, but not ourselves, that's about ego. That's about being seen to be compassionate. We have compassion for ourselves and nobody else. That's narcissism. You have to have the two in particular. And the hardest thing for formers to do is to have that compassion and forgiveness for myself. And what I learned along the way, and there's a quote from the Dalai Lama, is that the more we have compassion and forgiveness for ourselves, the more we diminish our capacity to do harm in the world. It hasn't been an easy journey. I've probably spent 1,000 hours in individual and group therapy working on healing that, healing the relationships with my children, all part of healing and getting more connected fully into my heart. So my ego is no longer driving the bus. If someone said, well, could you ever slide into being a neo-Nazi again? I'd say, no, I'd rather lose my life than lose my soul.
Mm. And he's doing an amazing job, Ezra.
Inspiring, thanks. I think that you all know that there's been a trail of damage done through your hate. I just want to say, there are forgotten acts of racism and hate. And I feel like what my question is, does Life After Hate focus on any kind of structurally implemented outreach programs for victimized groups of people who have kind of suffered at the hands of your acts? And is this a focus for the program beyond just being another coddled experience and kind of being a community beyond these hate groups? What do you guys do personally and professionally to ensure that this is just not another coddling?
Yeah.
Doing outreach and the interventions, that's one aspect of our work. And all of us as individuals have also been on our own personal journey of atonement and going back to the communities that we've harmed. I've gone to the gay community, and I almost went on my own personal Truth and Reconciliation Commission to the different communities that I've harmed. Not this last September, but the September before, with my coach and mentor, therapist or whatever, we went to, I'm a financial advisor by day, and that's how I earn my income. And I went to one of my clients who's Jewish and knows about the service side of my life with the Life After Hate stuff. And we were talking, and I said, you know, I've talked to Jewish communities all over the world, but I've never talked to the one in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. And that they were conspicuous by their absence. So I said, I want to address that. And he goes, he does what every good Jew who sits down, meets with an ex-neo-Nazi, calls his rabbi, right? And he calls the rabbi, and I go in and meet with the rabbi, and he brought me into that synagogue, and the week before the Day of Atonement, you know, and the event was called the Tshuva of a White Supremacist. And the Tshuva is the Jewish tradition of forgiveness and atonement. And that was the synagogue that I committed my very first act of anti-Semitism in, when I put a National Front sticker on the front door. Mm-hmm. And it brought it, 30 years later, brought it full circle right back to ground zero where it all started. So we're all constantly going on these missions of redemption and atonement. And each time we do it, I know it heals the communities that we're serving, and but it's healing for us too. And
I think my focus is, can you guys do anything beyond just a personal absolvement of guilt for these communities? Is it just primarily motivated by, you know, correcting your actions, or is it kind of really just about putting in the resources and the time into hearing these communities and doing the work for them, in a sense?
Right. So we also, the number two is the work we do with communities. Mm-hmm. And with the work we do with communities and how they respond to racism in the most effective way. So we go in and spend time with those communities of all different ethnic groups and everything, and provide education and advice on how to respond. So we do that as well. And then we do an awful lot of consulting with tech companies or educating law enforcement, mental health people, so that they can be more effective mm-hmm. at working with those particular groups. Possible was a group in creative agency in Seattle that we worked with, and they have a Twitter program called We Counter Hate. If you go to wecounterhate.com, it's there. And we helped them understand the six levels of hate speech, and they worked with artificial intelligence, machine learning, and Twitter to go and identify people and messages which are promoting hate on Twitter. Mm-hmm. It comes back to a person who helps the machine learn by saying yes or no. And what the program does, it replies to those hateful messages and says, this message has been countered. If you want to retweet this message, we're going to donate to an organization fighting racism. Mm-hmm. In the first 2 or 3 months that's been up and running, we've prevented 7.2 million tweets. Mm-hmm. 70% of the time that message has been deleted by the author. It dropped the retweets by 70% and 18% deletion by the author, all without using censorship. So we're involved in a vast array of community programs as well. We're sharing our stories here, but Life After Hate doesn't exist for us to heal ourselves. Mm-hmm. That's not what it's about.
All right. Appreciate it, thank you.
There's only two places that we operate from in this world, and that's fear and love. Mm-hmm. And so ask yourselves, which one are you gonna operate from?
Watch Fox News, that's fear, right? Fox and Friends in the Morning is not very friendly. It's all about fear, and it's how you wake up in the morning. You watch Fox News, you're gonna wake up all day, and you're gonna be biting your lip, and oh, they're doing it. We're on Christmas again? You know, it's all fear-based. And so if you can come at it from a different angle, like Tony just said, from compassion and love, I mean, it's just, what a world. What a beautiful world. I look at the world as beautiful now, and I could look at it like a Fox person, and it's not very beautiful.
Well, I'm sure you're all gonna join me in thanking Professor Michael Kimmel, Tony McAleer, and Frankie Mink for journeying a long, long way to be here tonight and help us to address and understand this better. So thank you very much. You have been listening to Healing from Hate, How Young Men Get Into and Out of Violent Extremism, a Cambridge Forum event being recorded live in Harvard Square. Cambridge Forum is sponsored by Lowell Institute, the Massachusetts Cultural Council, Harvard Bookstore, and the Ford Hall Forum. Thank you for joining us.